All right. Hi, and good afternoon, everybody. I'm continuing here on this Saturday afternoon, which is the 15th of September, and we're continuing with Rule 11, rules for magic on the astral plane. This is the 56th commentary in this astral plane series, and it's the third commentary regarding the 11th and last rule that we have. First, we have finished with the very first sentence in Rule 11. First, ascertain the formula which will confine the lives within the ensphering wall. Excuse me, and it seems that the higher grades of workers know those formulas, and we are in a position perhaps to receive something of them and clothe them in appropriate mental matter so they can be used in the lower worlds. We know that every form must have a boundary, and a boundary means there is containment of the internal constituents of the form, some force of coherence which holds the form together and which is activated by the formula which can be pronounced or given as a mantra. And probably every archetype on the higher planes, well, we've studied some archetypal lives. We have not named them, but they have this ability to conceive and sustain the archetype. And I suppose the formulas, which are the inherent essential archetype, will hold the archetype together and its relationships, the relationships of its parts together. The only thing in our whole, I mean, even the universe is bounded, as I understand it, by the self-perception of the universal logos. And the universal logos comes forth not as an absolutely infinite being, but as a being contained. And maybe it is even the absolute deity in its own self-perception that sends forth or becomes in part or emanates the universal logos, a finite and bounded being. Although the absolute deity in the post-Pralayic worlds and pre-universal worlds, I might call it post-Pralayic and pre-universal, is infinite. And well, there are infinities. I'm sorry. There are infinities after their own kind, but then there is what we might call the fount of all possibility, and in a way that might be called the absolutely infinite, which is articulated by the conscious, by the self-consciousness of the absolute deity, which has arisen from absoluteness in a manner, who is to say how? But the absolute is passive in a sense, incapable of changing, and yet it changes. So this is the great paradox. Now we have the second sentence, and we're going to give attention to that. Pronounce, so three things. The worker with the law must perform, or let's see how does it go? Three things the worker with the law must now accomplish. First, ascertain the formula which will confine the lives within the ensphering wall, and next, pronounce the words which will tell them what to do and where to carry that which has been made. So we're at that point now. And let's see, well, what little we can gather. Sorry, I seem to have a little something in my throat here, and apologize for the clearing. And where to carry that which has been made. Okay, so what do we say? Let us remember in connection with this rule that it is only potent so far as the worker with the law and every magician, or let's just say every white magician must be this, that the worker with the law is en rapport with the inner reality within himself. And the worker with the law, let's call him the soul-infused personality, is en rapport with the inner reality within himself, with the soul. It is so important that we discover our soul nature as a reality and as a next step, identify as that reality. There will be other phases of identification, but we must cease identifying as the personality. It is essential that through him, in full waking consciousness, the soul should be functioning. So let's just say all manner of exercises in soul infusion must be undertaken until it is an accomplished fact. It is the soul who pronounces the words. It is, well, yes, and it is the soul, and we as the soul who pronounces the words. It is the soul who utters forth the mystic phrase later that will save the magician from the work being done. It is the soul as controller or ruler of the mechanism of the form apparatus. So that is interesting. We, apart from the soul, cannot pronounce these words. if we judge or experience ourselves as apart from the soul, these words cannot be pronounced. This control is only possible where there is alignment of the brain and the mind and the soul. Notice he is reversing the order there. It's usually soul, mind, brain. And how should we detect whether we have this? There are higher streams of energy which the solar angel, that part of it, which is in our causal body, sends forth or through our causal body. Do we recognize these, our higher inspirations, the energies which seem to lift us up, which seem to put us in touch with something more subtle than we usually deal with? How shall we recognize these? Again, it is necessary to remember that this rule, being an expression of the creative work, applies to all creative process, whether macrocosmic or microcosmic, whether we are dealing with God as the creator of the solar system. So in this case, God as the solar logos, with the soul as the creator of the human mechanism, That's pretty much the solar angel, angel of the presence, or later, combined with our own higher nature. The solar angel or angel of the presence, later combined with the higher nature of the human being in question, or with the man as he attempts to master the technique of magical work and so become a creator of forms in his own little sphere. But we as a personality, and hopefully now as a soul-infused personality, have been, in a way, created by the solar angel and its projection, the angel of the presence, and our own, at least witnessing participation on the higher mental plane. Because the more we have experience in the lower worlds, the more we come to ourselves consciously, the more awake and alive we will be as a human soul on the higher mental plane. Or with man as he attempts to master the technique of magical work and so become a creator of forms in his own little sphere. All have to work out the true significance of the rule. For God works under the law of his being, and the law demonstrates to us, this law demonstrates to us as the laws of nature. Okay, so being has a law, and this law of God's being demonstrates as the laws of nature. And I would suppose, as the laws of the soul, of the solar system, and beyond. Notice the word God is flexible. We're not dealing with the immense logos of the universe. We're dealing with a being immense to us, the solar logos, who is embodying our solar system, but we're not dealing with the one and only God of this particular appearing universe. So anyway, there is a constant creative activity going on, and we want to make it more and more conscious. We want to be conscious workers with the law. How else could we work with the law? The law would work us, you know, as it does, of course. But we want to actually work with the law by understanding it. We must understand the law and not simply be moved by it. Okay. The ideas of ordered activity and of a conscious and purposeful goal are bound up in the phrase we are considering. Well, you know, let's just say the magician and the whole magical process, they are much ruled by the seventh ray, the ray of orderly process, ordered activity. The builder of any form is first of all a controller of lives and an arbiter, a decider, you know, Libra, of the destinies of certain entities. And I'll just here put next to arbiter, seventh, whoa. Sorry, seventh ray and seventh sign. Even though at the moment it does not seem that the seventh ray comes from the seventh sign, yet there are so many factors involved in seventh sign Libran process that suggest the seventh ray. So we control, we create forms and uphold forms and obey the kinds of forms we have created, which are supposed to be based on laws which are the expression of the will of the God we're talking about. In this case, it seems the solar God. The builder of any form is first of all a controller of lives and an arbiter of the destinies of certain entities. And thus it is even when we as a human being are creating forms, and there, let's say there are constituent members of the human race who are part of an organization that we have created, and we are in charge, and in some sense we control the destiny of the workers whom have come to us or whom we have gathered. In this thought, we have light thrown upon the subject of free will and upon the law of cause and effect. Let's just say human free will exists in some respects and is limited in others. There are limitations to human free will. FW, I think that's a good one, don't you? Let's try it. Free will. The only will that is absolutely free and uncompelled is the will of one than which there is no other. The will of one than which there is no other, or the absolute deity has total free will. Who is there to compel? Who is there? What is there to deny the freedom of it? The one actor, the one pre-cosmic and post-cosmic actor. Anyway, that, you know, I can't really help myself ranging off into certain philosophical considerations, but freedom is relative, really. It must not be forgotten, however, that the mystery of causes lies hid in past universes. All in their day, the forms indwelt by God. This is another way of saying our solar logos has had previous incarnations. In fact, four previous to this one. And our, what can we really say that? Our universal logos has had always more incarnations than one can count. We can't say an infinite number per se, but an infinitude of them. For us, there can be no such thing as pure cause, but only the working out of major effects originated in the past incarnations of our solar logos. At least for the moment, there are other causes. The original causes, cause or causes within our total universe emanate from the universal logos. And what being is that, we can't even see, but many religions feel that when they're talking to God, they're talking to the one and only being in the universe, and it's probably that idea would give way if a little further thought were given to it. Just as for us, such a reality as pure reason is totally incomprehensible and unattainable, so with pure cause. We might call it originating, uncompelled, and thus not an effect of a previous cause. I wonder if there is such a thing in the, well, I think there is, my view of this is that the infinite sequence of appearing and disappearing universes, that the members of that sequence are not causally connected. This is an idea that I'm playing with at the moment and have been playing with for 20 years, that each universe is not dependent upon a previous universe. I know that seems strange, perhaps, but is dependent only upon the free choice of the absolute deity, which in essence it is. So any universe and its universal logos is not dependent upon a previous universe and its universal logos, which is ultimately the same being. Only the universal, only the what can I call it? Post. I'm going to call it something strange. Post and pre-universal absolute deity. Papuat. Oh, I know. I shall be considered crazy at one point here, but okay. I'm going to post and pre-universal absolute deity. That's the only cause. Only this is a cause affecting the limits and structure of universes. I know one day I'll have to explain that. My youngest son, who's a philosopher, said to me once, "Dad, well, you've written a book here, and you're going to spend the rest of your life explaining it." Or maybe it should have been said, trying to explain it. These factors antedate our so now we're still in our particular universe in this causal chain. These factors antedate our solar system, and therefore speculation about them remains unrewarded except insofar as it tends to develop the mental apparatus. And that's not a bad thing. We do need that. This is, this, oh, Papuat. See, I forgot to go back to the blue bracket. So this is actually a good thing. And to develop that apparatus. No, it's not going to let me do this. So this is actually a good thing, and many are the opportunities for mental gymnastics, which are DEVL, developmental. Okay, and I'm going to make one of those, DEVL, and we'll call that developmental. All right. This solar system is a system of effects. I mean, it's the fifth in a series of solar systems and the second major, which in their turn generate causes. Okay, so this solar system is the fifth in a series of six or seven. Seven, if we look at the last solar system as the sum of them all, which in their turn generate causes. Only in the human family and only among those human beings who are consciously using mind power are any causes of any kind being generated. This is actually an interesting, maybe little digression here about cause and effect. But let's just say simply that thinking human beings create causes. All causes being initiated by a mind of some kind, functioning consciously and thinking clearly, posit a thinker. And this is profoundly the position of the occult sciences. So in occultism, causes require a thinker. Okay. Our solar system is a thought form, but one having real. Let's see if I can possibly save. It's giving me the same old problem. And, my hope is that somehow I can save. It's okay. Okay. Well, I have found one way to save. It's a very big file, as you can see. At least for Word, it looks, some 800 pages here. Anyway, our solar system is a thought form, but one having real existence as long as thought persists. All that is, forms part of the current of ideas emanating from the divine thinker. All thoughts are part of a divine stream. The mass of people think not, and so do not generate causes that must in due time produce their effects. Their responses are effects, and those effects produce further effects, but are not really considered to be causal. They do not, they're part of a particular stream. They do not direct, new processes. They cannot make the stream diverge or go in a different direction. So anyway, this is the occult point of view. Our solar system is a thought form, but one having real existence as long as the thought persists. So, whatever thinker it is, the solar logos stops thinking in a certain way, and the solar system disappears. And maybe whatever that being is as a soul stops thinking, and the entire personality of the solar logos disappears. And maybe the monad of that solar logos stops doing whatever it does, maybe it's thinking. And the triad and the soul limitations of that great monad also disappear, but somehow the harvest is always incorporated on the way back along the emanative stream, because there's no being other than the universal logos that in any universe is not an emanation. No being other than the universal logos, which in that universe or universal system is not an emanation. And maybe we have to, you know, widen our view of emanation and consider any universal logos as itself a kind of emanation from absolute infinitude, created by the self observation of the absolute deity, which is post and post-pralayic and pre-universal. Okay. You ask, where then the truth of the statement made by many occult books that the trend of life or cycle of lives indicates necessarily the future, and that the causes initiated in one life work out as effects in another. It just seems to have me in a bit of a loop here, and it's not too pleasant, I regret to say. Okay, so we're trying to deal with this question, where then the truth of the statement made that the trend of life or cycle of lives indicates necessarily the future, and that the causes initiated in one life work out as effects in another. What about this? Where lives are predominantly emotional and are physically oriented, it is not a particular life which sets the pace, but the group of lives simultaneously interacting with each other predisposes the future along certain lines. Okay, so the causal factor is not easily traced to one particular life when the trend has been emotional, non-mental, physical. Where the lives are predominantly emotional and are physically oriented, it is not a particular life that sets the pace, but the group of lives. And of course, this question, simultaneously interacting, in what way is that possible, we might ask? Because is one life not past, and then can it interact with another? But perhaps the skandhas, as they are called, of any one life interact with the skandhas of another. The skandhas can interact, perhaps. Okay. These are not easy matters. Simultaneously, that's the word, interacting with each other predisposes the future along certain lines. This is eternally true of all human beings at a certain level of conscious development where they are swayed by mass ideas. This is called, we might call it the stage of mass consciousness, molded unthinkingly by tradition and public opinion, and frankly, immersed in selfish interests and are not taking hold of conditions themselves, but are being carried forward on the tide of evolution. And that's important. You know, a certain Saturn, a certain Leo phase, a certain decisive phase of Libra is occurring, not yet occurring, rather. They are not taking hold. They are not gripping with Vulcan the conditions around them. They are drifting, they are being impelled, they are being compelled, they are not stopping and getting a grip on circumstances. So through Leo, Saturn, Vulcan, Libra, they will later reach a point where they stop and get a grip on circumstances. We're told of Leo, you know, that it conditions circumstances. and that may be later in the Uranian phase of the Leo energy. It is a form of group activity. They go along with the group, a bit like the group soul. They pass along into the future as a group, reminding one of the group soul of animals, but it's of course on a higher turn of the spiral. It is a form of group activity. Groups governed by the vibration of physical and astral forms, compelled, impelled, directed by those forms and not by their own center. These types are not directed from their own center. And it is this, these physical and astral vibrations which produces the characteristics and tendencies which cause the situation and environing circumstances. Let's just say this is not the same as causality produced from a thinker. It is a form of group activity, groups governed by the vibration of physical and astral forms, which produces the characteristics and tendencies which cause the situation and circumstances. Okay, let's call it this. Situation and circumstances caused by group activity. There's not really a thinking thinker behind it. And so the type of causality is different. It's just part of the stream of effects. Now, some people will say, well, whatever you even think about is determined, and you are actually compelled to think in a certain way, and your thinking is really an effect. There is that argument. But that particular argument, I think, is fallacious. There is within the human being, there is a sphere of self-determination, which is unconditioned. Okay, so let us say that for any human being of a certain level of development, there is a sphere, a protected sphere, a sphere within which he can work freely in his choice, unconditioned and uncompelled by previous activities. He is in spirit free, because in spirit he is actually all. He is the essence. He is the essence. And this is the old argument, is that which we consider to be free choice really an effect, really determined choice? And I'm saying that because in essence we are the one and only essence, there is a space regarding certain types of circumstances in which we can operate with free choice, thus with free will. In this realization lies hid the secret of racial and national karmic conditions. What should we say? There is a stream. There is a stream, and those in a certain race or nation are borne along on this stream of effects which predispose all involved to experience certain conditions and contacts. In these groups, the ordinary feeling, active man is immersed, and out of this immersion, he must find his way by discovering and using his mind. Now, this is a Leo phase. From mass consciousness, the man comes to himself in Leo and is then a point emerging from the mass. And he can choose at variance from the stream of effects which bears along all the others. So instinct must give way to intellect. You know, there we do want to read Alice Bailey's books, that book From Intellect to Intuition, and instinct is involved in it. From instinct, we must give place to intellect, from Cancer to Leo, from the moon to the sun. Instead of simply being borne along on a chain reaction of effects, becoming in a way, one's actions becoming effects in themselves, we stop, we center, we choose. So I think that's a formula that we have to at least consider. We stop, we center ourselves, and we choose. And, you know, in effect, we reverse the wheel. Interestingly, interestingly, both Leo and Libra are involved in this reversing of the wheel. Now, you know, the point of choice is reached in Libra. It's a very Saturnian sign, and you reach a point of equilibrium. You are, in a way, in Leo, you are an emergent point. Later, you will be a relinquished point, but in the beginning, you're an emergent point, and that emergent point can look both ways, and having reached a condition of stasis or balance in Libra, can decide which way it will go. And the idea is to go in the direction of Scorpio or in the direction of the spirit or soul at first, and not just go with the flow. So that is a mistaken notion. We do not want to, quote, go with the flow of effects which compel us in a certain direction, which is not determined by our own inner nature. For cycles of lives, groups of souls incarnate through the pull of the material forms towards which they are attracted. We have to remember that, you know. It's a matter of attraction, and it's not a matter of really intelligent, conscious choice. That's how we're pulled into incarnation. At first, there's no centering of the choosing being, and the looking at the alternatives and options, there's not enough mentality to do that. So again, reading that and thinking about it, for cycles of lives, groups of souls incarnate through the pull of the material forms towards which they are attracted. These material forms apparently have their own magnetism, and the souls are not strong enough to resist it. We can say that. Let's see here. The souls are not strong enough to resist the magnetism of the forms and are literally pulled off center. Well, really, the center has not developed. But, you know, all of this is about Leo and becoming an emergent point. You know, the last phase of Leo is the relinquished point, which is necessary for the achievement of oneness. But now we just want some kind of real evidence of active individuality. Individualization occurs, but it's pretty weak at first. And what does it take? You know, almost 3 million years to come to yourself after that event 21 million years ago when the arrow shot forth from the bow. Maybe 18 and a half million years ago, you begin to come to yourself, but you don't necessarily become a strong choosing center immediately at all. These attractive energies have earlier been utilized by the soul, finally being discarded and disintegrated. Let's just say the solar angel is in on the process. But I remember reading, but at first, other aspects of divinity are responsible for the reincarnational process. It's more of a mass kind of movement, but at first, okay, reincarnational. It is the potency of form which in the first case draws the soul into incarnation for the first half of the evolutionary process. For in the first half of the evolutionary process, matter, highly organized in the previous solar system, is the dominant factor. I think that is such an important statement about how reincarnation proceeds. We may think, you know, that something we are choosing, but I think that the downward gazing soul is not an immediate state. Let's just say the later RCZD. The later recognized, what's it called? Downward gazing soul is not immediately present, and the incarnations of man are left to other and more general agencies. So anyway, this is very important. I really want to somehow emphasize this and make it big, you know, so that it will hit the eye, really. It is the potency of form which, in the first case, draws the soul into incarnation. For in the first half of the evolutionary process, matter, highly organized and thus powerful, from the a previous solar system, probably, you know, the first major solar system immediately anterior to ours, and in which the intelligence principle is paramount. For in organized in a previous solar system, that's the dominant factor. So we realized that for a long time, the process of reincarnation is rather unconscious. So for a long time, the process of reincarnation is rather unconscious. Later we know spirit mounts upon the shoulders of matter. The mass interplay of spirit and matter is now so potent that one of the major experiences that a soul undergoes is the achieving of a state wherein the pull of matter begins to wane and the soul learns to detach itself. All right, and this is an aspect of the reversal of the wheel. This is the experience through which humanity is now passing. Again, a group activity on a higher turn of the spiral. And let's just say that personal interests are giving way to soul interests for many. And many are caught between the two. The wretched aspirant. I guess all of us have that experience of being torn and living wretchedly between two types of magnetism or two types of objectives. So I really want to emphasize, and for myself as well, that the first half or the first part of the incarnational process is quite unconscious, and that the attraction of forms is what is causing the incarnation to take place, and not so much a deliberate choice of a downward-gazing soul, soul or angel, angel of the presence, participating with the growing intelligence of that extension of the monad we call the man. Those factors are not yet in control. You see, there comes a point, and that should be emphasized, when the soul does downward gaze, and that is not immediate. The soul supervises in a large way at first. I mean, that higher entity that has us under supervision, and we don't know all those ways of supervision, but let's just say that there is supervision, but a general larger process is responsible for the coming, unintelligent coming into incarnation, determined pretty much by instinct and desire. Well, with what he's about to say, I have a real agreement. Large generalizations are indeed safer than the demand, than the detailed and oft erroneous information anent the rules governing the taking and relinquishing of form, found in much of our puerile literature, you know, the theosophical literature, and this many years for this type and this many years for another type. Between these generalizations should be regarded with much distrust. We do know we do incarnate, and probably what we become as a thinking being increasingly determines the incarnation. Later, what we become as a thinking being determines the direction and environment of our pending incarnation. But the solar angel does remain involved because, you know, the solar angel knows so much more and knows how to deal with the permanent atoms and how to build the vehicles and so forth. And we may, as we become more intelligent, have some kind of choice, which is not just attraction to certain forms, unintelligent and desirous attraction. But the solar angel is an expert in the matter of arranging and incarnation. And when it becomes a downward gazing soul, gazing, I think is the word, right? Downward gazing soul, then it takes a very, very active interest, because the rate, the tempo of improvement, the tempo of accomplishment will be much increased at a certain stage. And that long, long period of sort of unintelligent activity and form will be over, and the curve will no longer sort of hug the bottom line, but will really start rising. All that can be posited is that under the law of cause and effect, spirit and matter coalesced and the worlds were made. Governed by the same law, forms were created and became material expressions of the life urge. They were swept in and out of manifestation according to a rhythmic cyclic beat, indicated in still or initiated in still earlier solar systems. I suppose the tempo had a lot to do with the forms towards which these second aspect beings were attracted into form. So, you know, the earlier solar system built some pretty powerful forms with their own rhythms. They were swept in and out of manifestation according to a rhythmic cyclic beat, initiated in still earlier solar systems than the one immediately preceding ours. Aha, now there's an important statement, because the first solar system was physical, the second astral, the third lower mental, and the fourth personal mental, with some higher mind activity for some. Okay, at least this is my, you know, estimation. So all that can be posited is this much. And he wisely tells us, you know, don't go in for that kind of inaccurate theosophical exactitude, at least that appeared in the theosophical literature. Do not succumb to that. Well, there's so much we don't know, but, you know, if we make the best of what we do know and develop that thought and work, climb the mountain of vision for ourselves, DK asks us how much of the mountain of vision we have actually climbed for ourselves, then greater light will break forth, and when it comes into excruciating detail, comes to regard excruciating detail, don't deal with it as if it is sacrosanct, you know. Much can be modified when we know more. So spirit and matter came together, the worlds were made, forms were created, and became material expressions of the life urge. Life pervades both spirit and matter and soul, we're told by Blavatsky. They were swept in and out of manifestation, the consciousnesses arising when spirit and matter came together, according to a rhythmic cyclic beat, and the beat had to do with the condition of the attractive forms generated in earlier solar systems rather than intelligent conscious choice of the beings again going into incarnation. Groups of forms appeared and disappeared and were governed almost entirely by their group coherence and vibration. This is the, I think he's speaking here, of the group soul phenomenon. Pheno. phenomenon. So the life progressed through the elemental or involutionary kingdoms, through the three lower kingdoms in nature, and on into the human kingdom. And let's just say that life is the being, the true SBR, well, I want to have a word like substratum, you know. So SUB. Substratum. SUBM. We'll do that. Try that. And I'll just try to remember. Because that is the being. The being is the substratum. And it should be capitalized. Substratum. Okay, well, we've reached the 1 hour point, roughly. And we'll go on in just a moment. All right, 1 hour, roughly. I think we can all agree that this is not an easy book, and that the process through which we have all passed at one point or another, even if some of that was on the moon chain or maybe in a previous solar system, is presented in a clear way, but does not go too far, lest we enter into illusion as a result of the adherence to extreme detail, of which we are really uncertain, but which gives us the sense of security because it's very concrete, and yet it may be quite inaccurate. So there's groups of forms appeared and disappeared and were governed almost entirely by their group coherence and vibration. Now, is it true of the group soul, you know, for unindividualized animals, that whatever experience one of them goes through is somehow shared and becomes the experience of the other? And yet they do continue to develop their own characteristics. I don't want to call them personalities, although those characteristics will eventually become personalities. And I've mentioned it before, but Master Maurya told us, do not be surprised if a yogi overlooks entirely a so-called holy man and stops and takes interest in a dog in whom he sees promise. So let's go on. In the lower human stages and in the stage of animal man, pending upon individualization, the same group activity reigns. That's interesting. Only as in the involutionary kingdoms, becoming smaller and smaller groups, as the individual units achieve one by one the status of true self-conscious individuals and begin to work, eventually, I would say, as souls. So that's interesting how the groups, well, it's not exactly a group soul, but how the, this tells us how the group which moves together and relatively coherently becomes smaller and smaller with the emergence of a developing self-consciousness in the group's members. Because we don't now, do we? I mean, we don't move together as a mass. We are, you know, individualized, and so many of us have developed our individuality if we've entered that Leo phase. And we become self-determining rather than being determined by the mass consciousness and group desire forms and group thought forms. Let's just say we, as disciples, have become quite self-determining and are not swept by the mass desire forms and the mass thought forms. Then they not only become creators, there's Leo again, with the power of standing alone, Leo again, with the facility of clear thinking and accurate visualization, but demonstrate also that they are the possessors of the creative art or faculty of creative imagination, coming in with the unfoldment of the second petal of the egoic lotus, we're told. It's a pretty primitive state, but some form of creative art and imagination become possible because it's, in a way, governed more by the soft line rays, and imagination is coming in largely on the soft line from the astral body or astral plane, plane six, and well, not yet inspired by the Buddhic plane, plane four, but it's the soft line rays that imagine more. And, you know, we're told that people on the first ray and seventh ray soul may have trouble with imagination, so need the kinds of outward dramatizations which a process like masonry may give. And Hercules, maybe realizing this millions of years ago, created those dramas which were enacted so the men of the period could learn, simply by observing the dramas. Isn't it interesting to think of Hercules as a dramatist teacher? Sort of ray one soul, probably ray two personality, ray four mind, something of that nature. In the Destiny of the Nations, it does give his rays as compared to those of the Christ and those, there's one more. I can't, the rays of Jesus we have to assume. The Buddha, that was it, with his sixth ray mind and first ray personality and second ray wisdom soul. Okay, so they then not only become creators with the power of standing alone, you know, and finally that is Leo, with the faculty of clear thinking and, let's just say, some fifth ray and accurate visualization, but demonstrate also that they are the possessors of the creative art or faculty of creative imagination. We're discovering in various caves drawings that seem to be older and older, but in a way are quite young, it seems, given the assessment we're offered at present, quite young compared to the Atlantean civilization, which must have been magnificently artistic under the guidance of the true leaders who were not Atlanteans, but simply worked through the Atlantean civilization. Somewhere in the back of our minds, I guess we've all been through Atlantis somehow, except for a very few that have come in the Aryan, you know, egos that have come in the Aryan group, a very few, resides that sense of the magnificence of the artistic structures. One day we will know where we have been as an emanation of the monad, and it will make quite a good story. Everybody has their own story on the way to true spiritual development. The goal is certain, but the time taken and the paths pursued are quite variable. But one day all will be known, all will come into the light. We need not be overwhelmed by too much knowledge, otherwise we couldn't finish or do what we have to do immediately in front of us. I always use the example, suppose I'm playing the part of King Lear in Shakespeare's drama. I don't want to be troubled in my performance by having the lines of Macbeth inserted into my consciousness when I'm trying to be Lear. So there is a point at which excessive memory can crush out the successful performance of the task immediately ahead. He warns us about that. He talks about Scorpio, maybe on Pluto too, in esoteric psychology too, as ruling the factor of memory. And he says that dreams will sometimes bring up previous lives, and you better be ready for that, because not everybody is. They can be overwhelmed by those memories. And I think about the kind of detachment which we will need to see the story of our many, many lives, and it had better be as if it were happening to someone else. Otherwise, we would begin to act and interact with the presentation and not have the wise objectivity we will need to really learn from it. As the Buddha apparently learned under the Bodhi tree when, I don't know, was it some 555, that's obviously a symbolic number, lives were shown to him. Okay, so let's see, the lower human stages and the stage of animal man, let's just say not quite individualized. The same group activity range, we can't call it exactly group soul, but it's something different. Becoming smaller and smaller as the individual units achieve. Now, you know, that also applies to what's going on now. This also applies to human beings becoming initiates and entering the fifth kingdom of nature, and maybe the group of strictly human monads occupied with the fourth kingdom will be reduced as more and more enter the fifth kingdom. Well, we have to learn how to see things in the large picture, because in that way we can be of greater use to the hierarchy. They see things in a really big picture, but not so big as Sanat Kumara does. Our assessment of the world and the wider possibilities is growing. So they pass through life after life of self-sufficiency. I just got to keep on saying, you know, it's all about the first ray and Leo, in which the personality, now remember, there's no first ray personalities at that early point, only later toward the first initiation do first and second ray personalities actually appear, and first and second ray souls, which is interesting. They pass through life after life of self-sufficiency, in which the personality is developed and used, and then they begin to find their subjective group, which will eventually take the place of the outer material groups in their consciousness. And would we not say that as... okay, you see what that's going to be? That's going to be DSIN. What's it going to be? Disciples in training. Yes, I have. And as disciples in training, we should be having this type of experience. Thus, they regain again group existence, only this time in full awareness and control. So what we have here, it's a strange term, we have kind of an hourglass or egg timer with a narrow point at the middle, indicating a kind of perceived isolation. There was unconscious group formation, and after passing through the increasingly individualized expression, there will be conscious group formation in a subjective group. It's a pretty easy idea, and I think it's operative now. We, people such as ourselves, DK says, we've probably gone through a life or two in some kind of convent or monastery, and we've experienced maybe the height, some kind of acme of strictly personal expression. Those two experiences lie maybe behind us. And now the personality in its own right is waning as an object of our interest, and it becomes strictly instrumental in relation to the larger group objectives that we begin, of which we begin to become cognizant. Okay. In the group with which they find themselves subjectively affiliated will be found those who have worked with them in the earlier mass state. So we can assume that, let's just assume, Master DK, those of us who are strongly drawn to Master DK and his work have worked with him before, or rather, he with us. So they will find those who have worked with them in the earlier mass state also brothers and sisters, so that they work in close association with those who have been nearest to them or who have been linked with them in the general life cycle. So this has to do, not only with the teacher, but with those who have progressed with them in more ordinary fourth kingdom life. And they move together into the fifth kingdom. Well, let's just see, you know, that sounds logical. And you know how disciples say, we have known each other before. Well, they're probably right to a certain extent. It gets to be a bit of a platitude, but it's probably correct, and we work out all of our unfinished business as time goes on and the karma is adjusted. There are certain names given to these stages in the occult archives which are suggestive and illuminating. They are, of course, symbolic. You kind of wonder, you know, at what point of tension are these occult archives found, and I always joke, and where's my library card? And I haven't really gotten it yet. I don't think it's expired. I just think I don't have it. Maybe you're sent that library card in the subjective mail at a certain point. It might be of interest if I gave some of these ancient cryptic utterances which convey three items of information, namely the name of the stage, the esoteric color, and its symbol. Well, interesting information. Maybe we're not in a position yet to use it. But, you know, certain names given to these stages. Okay, well, you know, the state, what can we say? There's the stage of animal man, there's the stage of newly individualized man, there's the stage of the gradually growing individual. The early stages are quite group oriented, the stage of entering a subjective group. And even there, one begins to distinguish oneself. But then there's also the stage of the group initiation. I mean, those are the kinds of things I think of, but I'm sure DK has, you know, another approach in mind. I would like to point out, however, that these intriguing pieces of information, which I at times convey and which some of the students seem to regard as of vital importance, are of far less importance than that's a great teacher. Far less importance than the injunction to live kindly, speak words of gentleness and of wisdom, and to practice self-forgetfulness. May I fulfill my part in the one work through self-forgetfulness, harmlessness, and right speech. There's kindly harmlessness, right speech of gentleness and wisdom, and self-forgetfulness. There it is, the mantra of the new group of world servers, the 5 o'clock mantra. So, you know, there are certain arcane things which are tantalizing, titillating, kind of exciting in a secretive kind of way, and they just don't count as much as the more ordinary pieces of advice, about which there's nothing special, but which are so hard to fulfill. The occult data is read and noted. The familiar instructions are skipped and overlooked. Well, you know, he observes his students and he knows, he sees what they do. We are those students too, and we can ask, you know, where do we stand with respect to these fascinating tidbits compared to live kindly, speak gently and wisely, forget yourself. Where do we really stand with all that? And he makes this kind of remark often. He says, if I was to give you some breathing exercise, you know, you would really perform it assiduously, but if I just tell you to serve and obey, it's not very interesting to you. So the occult data is read and noted. The familiar instructions are stopped, are skipped and overlooked. We who work with aspirants smile oft at the foolishness and lack of judgment evinced by those we teach. Say to the student, practice with steadfastness the law of loving kindness. And he will say that indeed he will attempt to do so, but within himself, the very familiarity of the injunction palls and is deemed at best a needed platitude. Say to the student, I will give you some occult phrases or some items of information, and then the great ones, and with keenness and with excitement and with smug self-satisfaction, and with pleased curiosity, he prepares for the important revelation. Yet the earlier injunction is the conveyor of occult information and indicates the law which, if rightly followed, leads to the release, to release and liberation. The latter concerns phenomena, and the knowledge of it leads not the weary pilgrim to the gates of heaven. Some of you need this reminder. I just have to laugh. I just have to laugh. And, you know, our humility, if we can master it, really will direct us rightly. We want something so often unusual, novel, strange, different than others may get, things ahead of the reception by others, and it's all just lower ego, you know. So This brings us to a humbling realization. Loving kindness is the true occult practice. As always. Okay. So let's see. Loving kindness is the true occult practice, little as it may seem so. Well, how can we get beyond the need to feel special or marked out or in some way unique? How can we really begin to blend our identity with that of others in the group and in the larger group, and finally, in humanity? I guess there are many shocking moments when we realize how we have deviated from that possibility. Anyway, good advice, right? And to be followed. And if he's right, we'll say, oh, yes, of course. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, very good advice. And we'll look for that arcane bit of info, like the blue serpent with the red eye. I've always been interested in that big blue serpent with the red eye. It's found in the old commentary. Ignoring what will really open the doors through initiation to the kingdom of heaven. Loving kindness. Don't you think it ought to be made bigger? I tend to think so. All right. Those stages. Okay, see, these are from the old commentary, right? It's wonderful. I know these. I mean, I know them. I'm familiar with them. And I don't know if I've yet given a analysis and interpretation of them, but so much is seminal in a treatise on white magic. Really foundational material. So those stages which precede the human are omitted as none who will read these words possess the equipment to comprehend their inner sense. And we begin therefore with the stages of the human kingdom and all that is given below, concerns individualized man. Stage one. The life has climbed the stairway long through daily use of form. It goes into the other kingdoms too, comes from the other kingdoms. Through the lesser three, the progress slow. The long path has been traveled. Another door opens, stands open now, and the words sound forth, enter upon the way of real desire, or is it red desire? I would have to go to a book to find that out. I have no time right now. So you look it up. We are, some kind of externalization of the monad, some kind of extension. We pass, even while staying at home, so to speak, as the monad, we pass through the involutionary kingdoms, becoming denser and denser, and then make the turn in the mineral kingdom and start to become etherealized as we rise through plant and animal and into man and beyond, angel and God and all that. So the life has climbed the stairway long from the turn, we might say. Through daily use of form, through the lesser three, with progress slow, mineral, vegetable, animal, the long path has been traveled. Another door stands open now. The words sound forth, enter upon the way of real desire. Red desire, I think. Is it red? I suppose I would demonstrate my patience if I went looking for that book somewhere in the house. Is this red desire? Because, well, even from the books, you don't know typos can exist. All right. Now, somewhere I must be able to do this. All right. So, the life that knows itself as form enshrouds itself in vivid red, the red of known desire, and doesn't sound like real desire to me, any more real than the animal's desire. And through the red, all longed for forms approach, are grasped and held, used and discarded, until the red changes to rose, and rose to palest pink, and pink to white. Forth flowers then the pure white rose of life. It's like the sixth ray becoming the first ray, or it's an important transition. Let's just say we are the monadic extension. We are the life. Everything is the monad, put down into confinement, greater and greater confinement, and identified only with what is seen and sensed, and has no vivid sense of a center which is distinct from that which is seen and sensed, and wraps itself in the vivid red. I imagine at this point the astral body is very red, and the influence of the non-sacred planet Mars is very strong. Mars tends to rule almost every aspect of the personality, and certainly the dense physical form and the instinctual period, and really can be found in relation to the base of the spine center, the sacral center, and the solar plexus center, all of them, but maybe not the spleen. Although, you know, the spleen is very energizing, and Mars is the energizing planet. Through the red, you know, that kind of approach, it's got an attraction as well as an outgoing impulse to possess all longed for forms. Very dense approach. At first, they are dense, are grasped, held to ourselves until they demonstrate their, their insufficiency to satisfy. Are grasped and held, used, and then thrown away, because always the spirit operating within the astral body demands more and more release, and more ethereal possibilities, until the red, which attracts us to low things, changes to rose. It's a refinement, and it's a higher form of desire, symbolized by rose. It's a mixture of white, right? White is the spirit, and it's being mixed with desire. And the rose color, not red, interestingly, is found in the petals of the egoic lotus, though maybe first ray souls have an overall some kind of tinge of red, yet the petals are said to be rose and not red, at least at this time. Now, if there are causal bodies or egoic lotuses in the next solar system, maybe the red will appear. And rose, a greater admixture of the white of life and being, to pink, which means the desires are becoming extremely refined eventually. They are rising and pursuing more and more etherealized objectives until finally we reach white. Is this the condition of the final astral body? Which demonstrates pure love, finally, and may not even be considered a real vehicle, or is somehow so changed that the soul and other love factors can express through it, and it has no independent life of its own. Fourth, flowers, then the pure white rose. I remember talking to Marion Walter. You know, she was the last living disciple. Keith Bailey and I knew her as a friend back in the 80s, and I think she died in 88, right on WASAC. Keith was with her in the hospital when she passed, and she said, well, the rose of Master Kutumi is the white rose, the flower is the white rose. One never knows, you know. You take in what people say, and maybe it's accurate. And as I've said before, Moria, the Frisia, Tibetan, the Carnation, and the Christ, the Red Rose, maybe. But fourth flowers, then, the pure white rose of life itself, life being more than the will, life and being, even more than the will. And this is a long process. It's not happening immediately. In other words, we're talking about what happens with the astral body over many, many stages through which the new member of the human kingdom will pass. The tiny rose of living life is seen in bud. That's at first. Not yet the full-blown flower, and the full-blown flower, when the pure white rose of life is, you know, it reflects the monad, because two above is the astral body, two from the bottom, astral body, two from the top. It's not pancakes, but, you know, that's our diagrams, is the monad, and the life of the monad is somehow reflected in what was the desire nature. So the old commentary puts this in the context of time. I'm not writing down a bunch of things because I don't want to sort of get stopped by my own incapacity to spell rightly, and the position of my hand on this mouse pad, which makes things jump. So at first, the tiny rose of living life is seen as it in bud, and a great process of unfoldment lies before the man who pursues red desire, but this is more the savage state, really. And it involves the first petal, and maybe some of the second petal, you know, but especially the first petal, which is you can name it as an Aries petal, and thus Mars, the red of Mars, would be very prominent. So you just go after what you want, which is dense and gross, and you grab it. And the astral body of such a person would just be filled with red. Now, I guess when we get angry, maybe there's a flash of red and so forth. But in general, when DK gives a meditation on the astral body or controlling a desire and so forth, the color rose is being used now and not red. Red maybe would be used for the will, maybe there are not so many meditations right now on the development of the will. They're too likely to be misused. Stage two for our extension of the monad that we call the living being in form, or even the soul in incarnation. We are the life in form for a long time until we extricate ourselves from the form. The picture changes form. Another voice coming from close at hand utters another phrase. Now, it's not a distant voice. It's not a voice which is giving spiritual counsel. Let me read it first, you know, just in general. I think that's the best way to do it. The picture changes. Another voice coming from close at hand utters another phrase. The life continues on its way. Enter the field where children play and join their game. Awakened to the game of life, the soul passes the gate. The field of green, the field is green, and on its broad expanse the many forms of the one life disport themselves. They weave the dance of life, the many patterned forms God takes. The soul enters the playground of the Lord and plays thereon until he sees a star with five bright points and says, "My star." The star is but a point of light, not yet a radiant sun. It's interesting how he ends every one of these little chapters, these little, what can I call them? Sections, you know, with a look towards the future. It says, you know, the other one just preceding, not yet the full moon flower. And it says, not yet the ray. It points to what will unfold. So always we come under other vibrations, under colors, we rise, and the voice is coming from within the lower vehicles, not so much from the soul, which, you know, it's like the different mantras of astrology, which we talked about just a little while ago, you know, let form again be sought, let struggle be undismayed, let instability do its work, I'm going Aries, Taurus, Gemini, let isolation something, and yet the crowd exists, and so forth. These early mantras, evolutionary mantras, which lead to the ability as an awakening soul, or even as the soul on its own plane, to pronounce the words that we use now when we are attempting to get in touch with the zodiacal energy which is available. So another voice coming from close at hand within the, I don't want to say personality yet, just want to say within the lower vehicles and involving some of the mind, actually, utters another phrase. The life continues on its way towards ever greater possibility and refinement and less containment. And that voice says, enter the field where children play and join their game. Well, at this point, we're not even a little one. We're a child in terms of the unfoldment of our consciousness. And it is a game. It's not really for real. It's a learning process going through certain forms which can be later, certain forms of activity which perhaps later can be applied really when supervising the games or when learning about the divine plan and trying to bring forward the divine plan. But we all know about games. We say of them, yeah, they're interesting, they're fun, but they're not real. They're not part of the real process of bringing the plan to Earth, at least in any direct way. So it's out there on the field. And there's been some growing up that's happened and less tendency to fiercely desire and grab and kill and knock everybody else out of the way so you can have your desire met. Awaken to the game of life. The soul passes through the gate. It's a bit like Hercules passing through the gate at each incarnation, but this is a big phase. I mean, how many lives would it take to finish, to enter the games and play them for a while and say, well, I've had enough of this. I want to do something real. I want to do something that really is for myself rather than just this kind of, well, I can't call it mindless, but a bit of mindless enjoyment. And for what purpose? No purpose except maybe to build up some capacities which can later be used for more earnest purposes. The field is green, and green is of the third ray and of the mind. And there's a bit of green in the solar plexus. I wonder if I can find that. Let's just see. The word is green rose admixture. Admixture. Green. Let's just see. Okay, solar plexus, 10 petals, the color rosy. That's why I didn't get it. See, between rose and rosy, you might not find your reference with an admixture of green. So green always relates to the personality, like blue relates to the soul, and like red generically relates to the spirit. The colors of the first three rays in reverse. So the third ray is, with all of its activity, is involved. There's lots of activity in the third ray. And when you're playing these games and disporting yourself out there on the field, the third ray of activity is involved. It's not yet the ray of abstract mind. So the field is green. And it kind of represents an early stage. Green represents, you can use it with healing, and it seems to give some vitality. The heart center is not green as far as DK presents it, but many people following the sequence of the colors in a prism find the heart center to be green. But if the solar plexus has that admixture of green, and so desire is still there, but it's rose, rosy, and green. So it's a little bit higher desire and a lot of activity to fulfill it. And the many forms of the one moving life, and there's that word moving showing the life in action and the third ray, play games. It's sport. It's when sport is serious in its own way, but it ultimately, in a way, is not affecting the divine plan, but it is a method of training. He tells us the Olympics are like a method of training for initiation. But they are moving their bodies in all different ways and their minds and whatever counts as a personality at this point. They're learning all kinds of different movements. They weave. There's that third ray factor. The dance of life and patterns are being formed out there on the field, which are interesting in themselves and later will be useful. The many pattern forms God takes. Well, the second ray is the ray of the divine pattern, but we're not talking about that so much. We're talking about a lot of activity occurring in many patterns and people learning the games. Now, sometimes when you get into a field, you hear people say, well, they really know the game. They really know the ropes. That's like a web connected with the third ray, the ray of webs. The ropes are kind of that. And you know how to negotiate and climb down, climb up, and climb across. It's a bit like the spider. So you know the ropes. The soul enters as the soul in incarnation, right? Not so much the soul on its own plane. But the extended soul, the soul extended into deeper matter, enters the playground of the Lord. And, who is the Lord? Well, lots of lords. In a way, this whole thing is sponsored by the planetary logos, but the monad is the Lord too, and that's where the extension of the monad learns to play the game of life and plays thereon for a while. I don't, maybe a team player, maybe, or maybe just someone enjoying the activity with no further purpose seen in the future until he sees the star. Now, that star is going to be probably orange in color. He sees the star and five bright points. That is man, as the star. And he begins to have an individual destiny or see himself less as a member of the crowd, and that you can associate the green with cancer also, and with the mass consciousness and so forth. His individualization is not really showing so much before this, or his individuality, But at this point, it does, and he begins to really be the Leonian emerging point. The color of Leo is one of the colors anyway, is orange, and he possesses this star, my destiny, my fate, my lower personal self, but he doesn't think of it as lower, myself, my ego. Anyway, this is something that's going to shine before others. Others will recognize it and validate one and look up to one, and one will stand out, my star. The star is but a point of light, so it reminds you of the star of initiation to come, but it is not yet a radiant sun, but it will be. We will enter the great fullness of the soul as the sun, and even later, the triad and monad as suns on their own level. And any great source in cosmos can be considered in its totality a kind of blazing, radiant sun. You know how some people, they want to be a star, even now. They want to really be distinct. They want to really display their personality. You see this in the entertainment field, you know. And you hear all the stories about people who are naive and they go to Los Angeles to become a star, you know. That's the phase we're talking about here, but at least it's getting out of the mass consciousness and emerging as a point of light. Eventually one will be a radiant sun, eventually one will blend with all the other radiant suns, and eventually even the sun will be relinquished and become the relinquished point. Now, what now? We've entered a kind of stage of ambition where you want to distinguish yourself. Well, the way of red desire fails. It loses its allure. You just can't go grasping the lower things and expect to, quote, get anywhere or, you know, stand out as a significant human being and be admired by others, you know, admiration, recognition, all those things. You come on stage, everybody goes crazy, you applaud, they faint, you know how it goes. I don't know if you've ever seen any of those old movies of Elvis and his crowd around him, but boy, they screamed, they fainted, they half died, and he was a great star. He could sing too. The playground of the sons of God no longer holds appeal. Let me read it. The voice which has twice sounded from out the world of form sounds now within the heart. The challenge comes. Prove thine own worth. Take to thyself the orange ball of thy one-pointed purpose. Responsive to the sounded word, the living soul immersed in form emerges from the many forms and hews its way onward, its onward way. The way of the destroyer comes, the builder again. The tear down of forms, and again the tear down of forms. The broken forms hold not the power to satisfy. The soul's own form is now the great desire. I've got to say it, later part of the fifth petal, okay? And thus there comes the entering of the playground of the mind. But in these dreams and fantasies, at times a vision comes, a vision of a folded lotus flower, close petaled, tightly sealed, lacking aroma yet, but bathed in cold blue light. The orange and blue in some more distant time will blended be, but far off yet the date. Their blending bathes the bud in light and causes future opening. Let the light shine. Well, these are wonderful things. Gosh, I'm, you know, obviously the Tibetan has such a facility to translate the old language, the symbolic language, into words which are so evocative for us. Well, man, you know, doesn't want to be the brute savage and live just the instinctual life because he's awakened to higher possibilities within his energy system. So the way of red desire does fail. It loses its allure. Maybe there are not so many people today that are strictly pursuing the way of red desire, or we might call it the Lemurian consciousness, the playground of the sons of God. no longer holds appeal. Just one of the mass running around making patterns, not distinguished, not standing out, not noticed, just one of the many. And the voice, now notice we do know and we now have confirmed where that voice comes from. It's not coming from the soul. The voice which has twice sounded from out the world of form sounds now within the heart, which is the center above the diaphragm, the next center above the diaphragm, or next major center, because one of the pranic centers is also above the diaphragm, and below the heart. Okay, and so this has more to do with the essence of the person, with who he really is, with the soul part of his nature, or the possibility of growing into the recognition of the soul. This is a challenge, an interesting word. You know, you have to really mobilize yourself to meet the words that come forth at this point. Prove thine own worth. That's thine own. It's not prove the worth of the group, or, you know, just distinguish yourself. And as Master Moria says later, he says, make yourself indispensable. But that's another and later stage. But at least distinguish yourself from the many and the mass who are running around making patterns, mostly unconscious to themselves, on the field of green, using the mind in a sense, but not really being aware deeply of their own nature. Take to thyself the orange ball of thy one-pointed purpose. Orange is a color that's associated with the fifth ray, associated also maybe exoterically with the first ray. And remember that in the death chamber, it's orange light, which is separated from other colors, and only orange should be displayed as it helps separate and abstract the inner principles from the outer form. So again, you know, it's like separate yourself. Use the fifth ray to draw a line between yourself and others. Stand forth as the first ray. And you have some mental ability here. It's growing because of that fifth ray, which is beginning to emerge. It doesn't mean that it's any kind of high fifth ray, but at least be someone. You know, that's what that voice is saying. And be noticeable and be recognized and stand forth, so that others really know who you are. So it's a ball, I guess, which says it's still a game to be played, because, you know, balls keep rolling and they're unpredictable and you can use them in a game. I mean, think about our games, football, the soccer ball, the baseball, the basketball. Without a ball, could we play any games at all? Well, yeah, we could go rowing and, you know, we could go swimming and other kinds of sports. But field sports and all that, there's a lot of the ball imagery operating there. Take to thyself the orange ball of thy one-pointed purpose. So instead of just diversely operating with all different kinds of activities, we begin to really focus in, we begin to concentrate. Remember Leo, this is a Leo phase, it's orange. Leo in meditation rules the factor of concentration and thus a one-pointedness, drawing that diffuse consciousness of the mass consciousness into the point. Responsive to the sounded word, you know, really rising to the occasion, the living soul, and maybe one is always the living soul, but is understanding it more at this point, although really having not come to himself spiritually, the living soul immersed in form emerges from the many forms and hews its onward way. I mean, this is where you knock out the opposition. Something's in your way. If there's a tree in your way, you've got that machete and you fell the tree. If someone is in your way and you're in the early stage, you may step on them on the way to advancing your own cause. There was a movie long ago, and it was about Sir Thomas More and King Henry, and one of the traitors who was somehow working against Thomas More It was a moment all about ambition, a questioner asked him, "Well, why were you so public about what you revealed? Couldn't you just have kept it to yourself, or just, you know, quietly told somebody?" And says, "Well, no one would ever know it. No one would ever recognize me. You see, it stood out. I saw the person was so weak in their self-validation that they just had to be recognized for a traitorous action, which at least gave them a notoriety. So get out of the mass, really. Here, emerge as the point, and you're going somewhere. You're concentrated, you're one-pointed, and when you hew, you hack, things are in your path, you get them out of the way. You have the instrument to do it. The way of the destroyer comes. Now, if you look at the fifth petal of the egoic lotus, and a lot of this is going on in the fifth petal, you see the early part, it can be very destructive and very lower egocentric, you might say. And remember that Leo, which is the orange sign, has a lot of first ray in it, and that the fifth ray makes its way to the first ray when it changes. So there's a first ray quality here, and toward the orange of the fifth ray, which may not be its main color, but it is one of the colors, the way of the destroyer comes. And you're just not satisfied. You just want to climb higher and higher. And I'm remembering, well, you know, in the Three Penny Opera by, was it Kurt Weill? I don't know. There was a German musical kind of, the hero was Mack the Knife or whatever, and the phrase, "And running, he steps on your face." I remember that. Climbing the mountain, you don't care who else is climbing. You just knock them down if they're in your way. The way of the destroyer comes. You're never satisfied with what you've got. You always want more. I'm remembering a bunch of movies. I'm sorry, you know, but there was the big fall of the stocks back in 2008, was it, or 2007, right in there, and a very brutal guy in terms of wheeling and dealing was asked, "Well, look, what is your number? I mean, everybody's got a number of what they want." And he looked at the questioner. He says, "My number is more," he said. This guy, Josh Brolin, I don't know. He plays always the part of the bad guy, you know. Maybe he's not like that in real life. But you could just see more and more, that ambition, more and more. The builder, and again, the tearer down of forms, never satisfied with what you've got. You know, my boat isn't big enough. My house isn't big enough. You know, you go after what will distinguish you in the eyes of others. And when you break your attachment to the forms that used to satisfy you, the broken forms hold not the power to satisfy. You just outgrow them, you know, and you just want more. The soul's own form. Finally, you fall, you know, the tower, blasted tower. Something happens to you. The lower forms just don't satisfy. The tower falls. You come crashing to earth. Now, in the later part of the fifth petal, the soul's own form is now the great desire. And thus there comes the entering of the playground of the mind, because the soul, as we know it, is found on the higher mental plane, and the mind, of course, on the mental plane. So these two have to interact, and now you distinguish yourself more and more through your mind and its powers. I don't know if the second ray has really entered here, but maybe the third ray has, in a higher sense, entered. But but you know, the future is showing itself, but in these dreams and fantasies, at times, intermittently, not always, a vision comes, a vision of a folded lotus flower. Obviously the egoic lotus and its early condition. Of course, by this time the person really has unfolded more. But there is this vision of what the soul can be, or something else, some higher power, something greater than any form that you can grab at the moment. A vision of a folded lotus flower, close petaled. Well, that's the beginning stage, but maybe it represents itself to the dreamer in order to show the progress possible. Tightly sealed, he's way beyond that point now, and lacking aroma yet, but bathed in cold blue light, the blue of spirit. At least it shows a beginning point and an unfoldment that is to be. Orange and blue, they are complements of each other. In some distant time will blended be. So we might say that, well, in a way, the whole mental plane is orange, but the lower mind particularly and the higher mind has the color blue associated with it, maybe blue and orange. So these two complementary colors will blended be, and the higher mind and the lower mind will be related to each other through the soul infusion process. Orange and blue in some more distant time, not immediately, but maybe not so far either, will blended be, but yet far off the date. Well, anyway, let's just say we have to go through that whole stage of aspiration towards the close of the development of the fifth petal. And yet, by the time that fifth petal is developed, we've entered the kingdom of God and we are a first degree initiate. So how long does that take? Well, DK has told us to avoid making too specific speculations about dates and years and so forth, but it's coming. Their blending bathes the bud in light. Now that, really, the bud has been opening all along, but this is the vision of the one who sees future progress and causes a future opening and the full unfoldment of the egoic lotus and the conscious recognition of the full unfoldment of the egoic lotus, as probably can be granted to those who are approaching the fourth initiation. Let the light shine. Shine forth. At the end of that mantram that one of the disciples loves so much, there is a power that maketh all things new. It lives and moves, and those who know the self as one, as it go, okay, I'm going to go find it because should know it by heart, but and it just shine forth. There's 52 of them, lives, moves, and now we should get it. May the holy ones whose disciple I am show me the light I seek. Give me the strong aid of their compassion and their wisdom. There is a peace with which passeth understanding. It abides in the hearts of those who live in the eternal. There is a power which maketh all things new. It lives and moves in those who know the self as one, big self. May that peace brood over us, that power uplift us until we stand where the one initiator is invoked, till we see his star shine forth. That's the third initiation. That's what we're talking about here. So now in just a minute, I'll figure out why I went here to show that to us. Okay. Right. So, their blending bathes the bud in light and causes future opening. Let the light shine. Increasingly it does until the transfiguration occurs at the third initiation. And there is the real beginning of the glorification of the individual as the soul. That light is going to shine forth at the third degree. And increasingly radiant, a supernova at the fourth degree will come, and a great revelation at the fifth degree, as that's the name of the initiation taken then. Obviously, it has everything to do with the light. And on, greater and greater demonstrations of the light. So the second ray blue, you know, but in a way, the higher aspect of the fifth ray is indigo blue. So indigo blue and orange, maybe, you know, they're quite complementary, and they will blend. The soul will infuse the personality. The higher mind will infuse the lower mind. Three minds will unite. And the lotus bud, the first nine petals, will be opened entirely by the third degree. So he's looking back at a time, you know, which was earlier in the process than where he stands now. But it gives him that sense of progress, and the vision of unfoldment comes to him. Okay, he's not yet a soul. He's still in the orange. He's still hewing his way. He's still distinguishing himself, but he's not satisfied. So many forms that he's grasped, even though they may be higher forms and show a lot of capability and all that, they just don't satisfy, and comes the vision of the soul, and the higher of the pairs of opposites really comes into his inner sight. By the way, 10 minutes ago, 2 hours had passed, so I'm not, you know, I'm just going here now. Stage four. You know, there was glory before, but it's not now. Into the dark the life proceeds, a different voice seems to sound forth. Enter the cave and find your own. Walk in the dark and on your head carry a lighted lamp. The cave is dark and lonely, cold it is, and a place of many sounds and voices. The voice of the many sons of God, left playing on the playground of the Lord, make their appeal for light. The cave is long and narrow, the air is full of fog. The sound of running water meets the rushing sound of wind and frequent roll of thunder. Far off, dim, and most vaguely seen, appears an oval opening, its color blue. Stretched athwart this space of blue, a rosy cross is seen. And at the center of the cross, where forearms meet, a rose. Upon the upper limb, a vibrant diamond shines, within a five-pointed star. The living soul drives forward towards the cross which bars his way to life revealed and known. Not yet the cross is mounted and therefore left behind, but onward goes the living soul, eyes fixed upon the cross, ears open to the wailing cries of all his brother souls. What is so beautiful. But from the personal radiance, which is not yet the transfiguration, the dissatisfied soul in incarnation is told to go into what looks like relative dark. He's calling this extension of the monad the life, so it's a good thing to call it, I think. A different voice seems to sound forth, and it's not a voice of the vehicles or coming from the form, it's a voice coming from a higher source, probably from the soul within him. The soul that he more essentially is, coming from the higher mental plane, enter the cave. So in a way you shut yourself off from all the natural forces and you're cultivating something else altogether behind the scenes, in which will allow you to control the natural forces. And find your own, find your fellow aspirants, find your fellow disciples, find those who are tired of the process, early process of the fifth petal, wherein you are just following your ambition. Probably you've had some kind of fall in the middle of the fifth petal, and you said it's all not worth it, and there must be something else. Surely there is more. And they have had the same experience, and they enter the cave. It will be eventually the cave of initiation, and they walk with you, and you find an inner fellowship, which is not just running around the green field with others. You find a true inner subjective fellowship after having gone through that very individualized standalone period. The cave is dark and lonely. Well, in terms of the kinds of outer contacts you used to have, cold it is. You know, it doesn't have the sunny warmth of sunlight on the outer, in the outer field. All the things which normally warm us and make us want them, the law of attraction and magnetism is not operating in the same way, and we're beginning to move towards what is called the clear cold light, and we will be cold to all that form has to offer. We will not respond as we go on in the cave, because we want something else. A higher voice is speaking. Cold it is, in a place of many sounds and voices. The astral plane is filled with all kinds of sounds and words and promptings, and also we can still hear the voice of the many sons of God. They're out there, they don't know, they're in the hall of ignorance. They're left playing on the playground of the Lord, but something in them bothers them. And they know there must be, you know, they are becoming dissatisfied. And even those who are still playing with the orange ball, there must be something more. So they want more light, really, even if they don't know they want more light. That vision of the dreamer, of the soul unfolding in the light, let the light shine, is an example of wanting more light. The cave experience is tough. It's long. It takes a number of incarnations. It's narrow. You can't just wander here and there. You're not on the primrose path. You have to cue to the direction. You can't fall off the path and wander. If you do, you'll just be brought back. And you don't want to get lost in those even smaller caves off the central cave. You know, it might take a long time to get back. So it's a lonely experience. The air is full of fog because you're encountering and recognizing the glamours around you. Remember that you're not yet the initiate. You are becoming that. So you have to face fog. You have to face this long cave is really, you know, in a way, the cave of initiation. You entered it and you're not yet an initiate, even of the first degree. So you have to encounter the fog of glamour, which has to be dissipated before you can make real progress. The sound of running water, you know, the many desires, meet the rushing sound of wind. Let's say that's the sound of your many thoughts. And you know that when wind and water meet, you sometimes have those storms and rough water and turbulence, emotional turbulence and so forth, and the frequent roll of thunder. But the thunder, interestingly, his symbol is the thunder, the word which follows him down the ages. It has to do with the second of the old commentary verses on the rays found in Esoteric Psychology 1. So lightning is the symbol of the first ray and thunder of the second. But this is more, let's just say, more menacing. And you know that you're living through stormy and turbulent times when you have to finally, as a awakening soul in incarnation, get all of these elemental forces under your control. Far off, dim, and most vaguely seen at first, appears an oval opening. Now, interesting, some causal bodies are oval, some are spherical. But this has something to do with the causal body. You're going to have to, you're attracted toward it at the end of the cave. Its color is blue. Blue is the color of the second ray. Blue is, in a way, the esoteric color of the causal body. It's the esoteric color of the orange, of which it is the complement, right? So its color is blue. Stretched athwart this space of blue, a rosy cross is seen. Brothers of the Rosy Cross, you know. Not a red cross, that's different, and it's the symbol of a great humanitarian agency of which the Tibetan is one of the sponsors, you might say. He's strongly behind that. You know, he has a lot of the whole medical approach and to bring relief. But anyway, the Rosy Cross, the desires have been elevated now. And when Master Kutumi is operating, he's using devas that are rose-colored and blue-colored. These are the colors of the second ray and giving the possibility of the love aspect entering the life more and more, as is found in the egoic body that has been pervaded by the buddhi, as it increasingly is. The causal body brings in more and more of that second ray energy, and the solar angel, whatever its ray, has a lot of that second ray energy. So you see the possibility of a different aspect of divinity ahead of you. Stretched athwart the space of blue, a rosy cross is seen. There comes a time in our lives when we see that rosy cross, and at the center of the cross, where forearms meet, a rose, and there is the blossoming of the love aspect. It's the symbol of the Christ at this point, and I suspect it's a red rose, you know. which is the possibility of the Christ consciousness if we pass the cross, which we all have to do by the fourth initiation. Upon the upper limb, we don't know yet the shape of it. Is it equal-armed? Is it what DK sometimes calls the cross of divinity, which has a longer arm? A vibrant diamond shines. That diamond is the diamond of the soul. And it is the jewel in the lotus. And it is full of power, and it is vibrant, and it has seven radiations, and the number eight is also connected with it. With a five-pointed star, within a five-pointed star, the star of initiation, we really begin to see that star as initiation proceeds. By the time we overturn the cross, higher initiations are underway, and we do meet Sanat Kumara as a five-pointed star, and then we meet him as an eye, and then we meet him face-to-face, initiations 3, 4, and 5. So let's say we begin to get the sense of the jewel in the lotus as that vibrant diamond shines, and our diamond shines, and the power of our own soul, and it's on the upper limb of the cross, so it has to do with from the heart to the head and the higher chakras. The living soul, that's what we are at this point, the living being consciousness, drives forward. First ray is being applied. Driving forward through space, it's called. The ray of progress onward, driving forward through space towards the cross, which, you know, is becoming more and more clear all the time, towards the cross, which bars his way to life. Beyond that is the great factor of being. Beyond love is being itself, will and being, which bars the way to life, revealed life, and known life. So far, life has been active, but it's been pressing the pilgrim forward, driving him forward, and now he has to really go on his own willful initiative. The will begins to mean something to him, and he knows he has to surmount the cross. Not yet. Now, here we are. Where are we? Not yet having fulfilled the requirement. Not yet the cross is mounted, fourth degree, and therefore left behind. Only way to do it is to mount the cross each in our own way and go through the great renunciation at the end of this long and narrow tunnel of initiation. And I think there's some funnels, if I can find them very quickly. I'm in a bit of a rush, sorry, because I have some webinars coming up here. Oh, unfortunately. Well, fortunately and unfortunately, you know. So anyway, FDISC, and this is the extracts, and I wonder if I have something called funnels. No? Working on it? Come on. Oh, funnels of ascension? Here we go. Ray and initiation. Okay, and there we are. The cave. First initiation, second initiation, widening, third initiation, fourth initiation, and into wider life. And it still keeps going, of course. This is found in esoteric, the rays and the initiations. It's a wonderful chart which does not yield its secrets immediately. But we can see that the different posts are there, and we can see that, I call them funnels of ascension. I guess this is the same thing. But maybe it's going to be, oh, come on. Look below. All right, I will look below. Yes, as long as I'm given instructions to look below. And there they are. Okay. Well, maybe you want this. Anyway, turn to some page or other here. I'm not sure which page. Unfortunately. You can find it. So, let's go on. The living soul drives forward towards the cross. The first ray is coming in more and more, and certainly by the third initiation, the first ray is operative, even though it's an initiation ruled by the fifth ray. But onward, onward, onward goes the living soul. Progress onward. Eyes fixed upon the cross. What can I give up? What can I sacrifice? What can I renounce so that the divine plan can appear. Ears open, compassion, to the wailing cries of all his brother souls. He, even though he's in the cave, he hears the pain out there on the playing field, and probably a lot more pain from those who were involved with the color orange and have experienced the crash, and surely there must be more. Okay, and now, stage five. Out into radiant life and light. The cave is left behind, the cross is overturned. The way stands clear. The word sounds clear within the head and not within the heart. Enter again the playground of the Lord, and this time lead the games. The way upon the second tier of stairs stands barred, this by the soul's own act. No longer red desire governs all the life, but now the clear blue flame burns strong. Upon the bottom step of the barred way, he turns back and passes down the stairs onto the playground, meeting dead shells built in an earlier stage. Stepping upon the forms discarded and destroyed, you know, you put your foot on the serpent, as it were, and holding forth the hands of helpfulness, upon his shoulders sits the bird of peace, upon his feet the sandals of the messenger, not yet, always anticipating, you know, what's coming ahead, not yet the utter glory of the radiant life, not yet the entering into everlasting peace, I wonder when, but still the work and still the lifting of the little ones. It's so wonderful. And, you know, I just wish I didn't have to stop. But I will have to stop soon. Okay, beyond the great renunciation and all its apparent and you know, real pain and isolation and feeling of abandonment and my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And the world can't help either. You're all on your own. You're carrying your own cross, you know. But now, into the anticipation of the fifth initiation, radiant life and light, and it is the initiation of revelation, and that connotes great release of light, showing the way ahead on the way of higher evolution, which is what is barred to us right now. The cave is left behind. That period of severe disciplining when you are cultivating that relationship to the inner causal world and no longer an extrovert in a way turned outward and involved through wrong identification with forms. You've learned to detach yourself. The cross is overturned. You've made your renunciation. And it is great compared to all the renunciations you've made, and it is, in fact, the sum of the many renunciations you have made. The way stands clear. Now, what is it, the way? And I just will write one thing. I'll call it W-H-E, the way, W-H-E. Way of higher evolution stands clear. You can't tread it yet, however. The word sounds clear within the head. Now, this is occultism and not within the heart. We've moved up to a higher correspondence of the lower centers, and there is, of course, a heart center within the head, and there is a, within the seven chakras within the head itself, so that, you know, the heart and the head is found above the head, really, in the thousand-petaled lotus, but within the seven centers within the head, there is one that is the higher correlation to the heart center. Enter again the playground of the Lord. You know how Leo loves games. Well, the fifth initiation is ruled by Leo in a way, and its first ray, and it's kind of a great glorification. It's the number five. It's a numerical correspondence. Enter again the playground of the Lord, and this time, you know, you're very conscious. You know what you're doing. You know what the divine plan is. To a great extent, lead the games and, you know, set out the rules and make sure people play by the rules and watch them slowly grow. The way upon the second tier of stairs stands barred. Now, that's the way of higher evolution. It's, well, it used to be that you could go on that way at the fifth initiation, and now it's the sixth, and this by the soul's own act. Which soul? Well, us as a triad, perhaps, or still the solar angel has returned to its source within the sun, so some higher agency has barred it, or the higher consciousness within ourselves, because the soul doesn't just stop when it leaves the causal body, you know. There's triadal soul, monadic soul, and so forth. Soul is consciousness. No longer red desire governs all the life. Long, long past Mars is overcome. But now the clear blue flame burns strong, the flame of spirit, the flame of love, wisdom, which comes in because of all the fire signs. Leo is the one that brings in consciousness in the second ray the most. Not Aries, not Sagittarius, but Leo. So the blue flame of alignment with the second aspect of divinity comes in, and ever since the Great Renunciation, you've been in deep connection with the second aspect of divinity. Upon the bottom step of the barred way, you know, you're making that decision about where you would go. Maybe these days, Sanat Kumara does not release you right away because you have to stay and help, okay? And this, the person here or the being here has to do exactly that. No longer the red desire governs all the life, but the clear blue flame burns strong. You know, in some of those lists and letters on occult meditation, blue is at the top. And remember, we have a second ray soul on our planet and second ray soul for our solar logos. Blue of the second ray is most important. So we're no longer green. We're no longer red. We are probably deep blue. And instead of going ahead, because we can't, we're not allowed, we don't even allow ourselves to go ahead. And maybe Sanat Kumara does not allow us to go ahead, but says, register your decision and now go serve. And when you come back, you can go. I mean, I'm, you know, obviously simplifying all that. Upon the bottom step of the barred way, he turns back and passes down the stairs onto the playground of green, you know. The masters are sacrificing a lot. Who are they working with? Master DK says, don't you know there are other things that might interest us other than taking care of you? Okay, puts things in proportion and passes down the stairs onto the playground, meeting his past, seeing where he's come from, meeting the dead shells built in an earlier stage. He held onto these things. They did not satisfy. He cast them aside. They are useless. They have not disintegrated. Maybe he has to make sure they do disintegrate. Stepping on forms discarded and destroyed. Well, he has to make sure they're all destroyed. Otherwise, they might lead other people astray. And holding forth, you know, in other words, saying, don't do this. Find your own desires. Don't just, you know, latch onto my discarded forms, the ones that I thought were so valuable. And holding forth the hands, both hands, of helpfulness to the ones playing on the green field and even to the ones who are seizing the orange ball and who have crashed and realized the futility of what they've been after and want something else. And then this beautiful image upon his shoulder sits the bird of peace. It's the dove, I guess, and you're reminded of the second initiation that Jesus and or the Christ enacted, and the position of the dove, and upon his feet the sandals of the messenger of the hierarchy, and that's Master DK, one of the great messengers of the hierarchy. He's turned and retrodden the stairs and done all this, and that's he's helping us in various places where we find ourselves. The disciples and his word will go forth and help others of thus far lesser rank. But he does bring peace. He does bring understanding. He does bring harmony. He has the Buddhic vibration. He knows to an extent the will of God and the purpose of God. And he knows the divine plan, God, the planetary logos in this case. Not yet. There's more ahead, right? Not yet. The utter glory of the radiant life. Well, you know, when you're on the way of higher evolution and you make your choice and eventually you're released from the cosmic physical plane of the ninth initiation altogether. You still have other initiations, but even beyond the fifth initiation, there is the utter glory of the monad, or great glory of the monad, and more radiance. The sun enters the seventh initiation. Somehow the solar logos is more involved there, and on into ever-growing brightness. Not yet the entering into everlasting peace. I wonder if that is when that is achieved, because it seems to me when you finally reach, in whatever form you do reach it, the universal logoic being, maybe that is the everlasting peace. But I wonder what everlasting peace really is. You know, maybe the absoluteness is everlasting peace, and the whole universe would have to dissolve before that entering in occurs. But still the work, and that's for all of us, even for a master, still the lifting of the little ones. That's what a master is committed to, and for a long time before he makes his decision that he will pursue the way of higher evolution. In other words, is the decision made immediately at the fifth degree? Maybe not, but one knows one has to help the little ones at the fifth degree and produce one's masterpiece, which gives a great lift to the little ones. You know, for Master DK, it was all that he did with the Theosophical Society and the Secret Doctrine and all the work with Alice Bailey. This amounts to a masterpiece, I guess, and some little reflection of that occurs at the third initiation. You know, so those of us who, you know, would like to see that in sight at some time in this incarnation or those to come, we have to think about what our mental formulation will be that we present to the world, which will have some value. Oof, it's just such an exciting, stimulating, inspiring, maybe should be the word, vision, and in the old language. Okay. So let me then go back, because the time is coming. time is closing in on me anyway. So let's see what it says here. If I dare go any further, I don't want to rush into that. Here in symbolic form, we have pictures of human life in progress, of life in form and growing through the building process, which marks the creative work. Growing through the building process, not just going through it, right? It is only a bald translation of some mantric phrases and some basic symbols, and must in no way be considered to be anything except indicative of a progress veiled and couched so that only those who know can understand. Esotericists will understand that these five stages cover the period, life period of every form, no matter whether the creator is cosmic, planetary, or human. Okay. It's marvelous, and I'm just going to say, even though I'd like to reach the 3-hour mark, I can't. And I'm just going to say enough for the moment. So this is the end of number 56 and the beginning of number 57. And we're going to go into rule 11, number 4. And today is the 15th of September. And this was number 3 we talked about. And now, what page are we on? Let's see. Page 470. So this has gone from 463 to 470. Okay. And we're going to begin on page 470 to whatever. however we get, however far we get, and on whatever day we do it. You know, I just have such a drive to go on with this, but other duties call, and one has to be ready for them. Well, so, you know, he's not making much of these stanzas, and he calls it a kind of a bald translation, a rough translation. Is that it? Bold translation of some mantric phrases. Imagine being able to read these. You know, we study different languages, and they are interesting. But the greatest of all languages, as far as humanity is concerned, are in the inner repositories and the inner libraries. And Master DK has managed to have access to them and to understand them and to present something to us that represents them in a very intelligent and evocative manner. So at least we understand there are different stages of ascending man, from the red to the green to the orange to the blue rose to the great radiation after that, you know. And this is the future for all of us, and the future for, on their own level, the future for other creators too. They go through different analogous stages to the human, even cosmic. So, you know, there's all kinds of things we can extend as we think about what the greater lives do that somehow hold an analogy to what the human does. I'm wondering about everlasting peace, you know, because on those paths, on the way of higher evolution, I don't think there's much peace, but maybe there's an interim before stepping upon those paths, which gives an expression of, gives an understanding of what that everlasting peace is. I mean, you know, even galaxies are colliding, and there are all kinds of interactions between stars, and they look a little turbulent. So everlasting peace, you know, to me anyway, represents absoluteness, or is the factor which we could predicate. We shouldn't really predicate anything at all of absoluteness, but or predicate all things of it. That's where I think we would find it. But okay, I'm not going over this with a absolutely fine-tooth comb. I'm not looking at everything, every little detail. As he advises, take the big picture, and that's what I think we have done. Okay, friends, that's it, about 2 hours and 43 minutes or whatever, and we will go on next time, continuing, and we are now about 30, well, not quite 40 pages to the end of this rule. And hoping to finish this in the next few days so that you at least have all the rules for work on the astral, magical work on the astral plane. And then when I can, and it won't be immediately, I'll get into the last four rules, which deal with the etheric and the physical plane. But we are, you know, somehow almost three quarters of the way through the book. Okay, many blessings, lots of love, study hard. There's a lot to study, isn't there? All right, see you soon.